Okay, thank you very much, Rabbi Cement. I want to thank you for the introduction, but even more, I want to thank you for inviting me. It's really a schus to be able to be here and to participate in this wonderful kolel, the Torah learning that you've created in this community and broader in South Florida. And I certainly reciprocate the sentiment of what an honor it is to call you a colleague and friend, and to watch with great admiration of what you've created in this community, the explosive growth. It's really something which is tremendous and fantastic, and it's a covet, it's a great honor to be here with you, and to welcome Rabbi Billet, my friend, and to be able to learn Torah together is something very precious and something very beautiful. Before we begin the learning, which we're dedicating to Rabbi Cement's grandmother, Le'iloi Nishmasa, just a shameless plug, Rabbi Cement has permitted for a couple of programs that are coming up in Boca Raton Synagogue. Boynton is not that far away, and you're all very much invited. The first one actually is tonight, and you don't have to get into your car, you don't have to travel anywhere, because it's a conference call we're hosting tonight that you can listen to from the comfort of your home. You could dial in, or you can watch online, live. It is an intimate conversation about intimacy that many marriages are struggling and some even failing because of dysfunction. In that particular area, a noted therapist, an outstanding therapist, Naomi Berger, and I will be having a conversation tonight at 8:30 p.m. The dial-in instructions, or to be able to watch on the web or on the flyer, you could send in anonymous questions in advance or even during the conversation itself. And if you call in, there's complete anonymity. There's no stigma attached. You can watch by yourself, with a spouse, and so on and so forth. The second is a flyer for our upcoming Women's Health and Halacha Day. Each year, the last number of years, we've dedicated a Sunday, Women's Health and Halacha. We have 12 different sessions, incredible talks, great subjects, great speakers, and everyone is invited and encouraged to come. Our topic today is, I think, a fascinating topic. It's a topic that sometimes garners a lot of emotion, a lot of controversy, a lot of passion on the different sides and perspectives. We find ourselves reading what many enjoy as the most accessible or interesting sefer of Chumash. Not that we should favor one over the other, but Bereishis is full of stories. We meet fascinating personalities, our avos and imos, our patriarchs and matriarchs, after whom our lives are styled and fashioned, and whose footsteps we walk, Maisa avosim and labanim. And when one reads the unfolding of these stories, the drama that ensues, that includes a lot of, dare I say, dysfunction. You know, they say the definition. You know what the definition of a dysfunctional family is? Any family with more than one member. So when you read Chumash Bereishis and you see sibling rivalry and you see conflict and you see alienation and you see Sarah throwing a stepchild out of a home, one can't help but recoil and look at it and say, what's really going on here? And what I want to share with you, what I want to talk about for our time, Rabbi Cement, didn't tell me how much time. Mincha, what time is Mincha? Whatever amount of time we have, someone will wave a flag or a yarmulke at me. But what we want to discuss in that time is it legitimate for us, do we have the license and liberty when reading the Parsha to choose to see the Avos and Imahos as anything other than perfect? Must we maintain this pure, pristine, infallible impression that our ancestors, particularly the Avos and Imahos, are untouchable? They're beyond reproach. You can't see any shortcoming in anything that looks like it's manipulative, a deficiency, poor judgment. You have to say, we don't understand. We're finite, we're limited, we don't understand, but they're perfect. Or is one entitled to read Chumash, entitled and maybe even encouraged, and say, no one has ever been perfect, and certainly their status is so much greater than ours. We're supposed to, Chazal tell us, we spend our lives looking and asking ourselves, when will we reach the level of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, Sarah, Rachel, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah? We should use them as the barometer and the metric through which we measure our virtue. But yet, despite seeing them with awe and admiration and categorically different than us or anyone we know, but it's legitimate if you see something to be able to learn from maybe something they did wrong. Those are two different perspectives and attitudes which have been brought to biblical exegesis, which is a fancy way of saying studying the Parsha. Are the Avos and Imahos beyond reproach? Are they untouchable? Do we have to actually somehow reread a story to see them as perfect? Or are we entitled to see them as fallible, imperfect? And the imperfection is not so we can criticize them. You know, we live in a world today spurred by the media, particularly right now these days, but social media and everything, we hold out our microscope and we hold out our telescope and we search for people's imperfections so that we can negate them, so that we can say they're no good, so we can reject them, so we can disqualify them. Chalila, that would never be our intent when studying Chumash, to look for an imperfection so we can say they're not a role model. I have nothing. People like to say that about rabbis, about community leaders, about people in any position of authority. You look for the imperfection, and when you discover it, it justifies why you don't have to really look up to them or learn from them, or you're not bound by their authority because you discovered the imperfection. That's not our goal. The Avos and Imos are forever and in perpetuity who they are. And if we discover an imperfection, it's only so that we can learn from them. But that's the question. That's what we're going to discuss. Beyond reproach, infallible, or humans? Imperfect, infallible, can we learn? So I want to take you through a little journey through some of the perspectives, and then we'll see actual sources and study some Chumash together inside. And it begins on page number 1. This is the Shabbat Shalom message of Rabbi Shlomo Riskin. Rabbi Riskin today is the chief rabbi of Efrat. He is incredibly accomplished. He has influenced countless people. He's been a tremendous source of inspiration in the world of outreach. He's built the community of Efrat with such vision. I share this not to share any personal editorial comment, but as a only historical comment that Rabbi Riskin used to put out, still does in numerous Jewish newspapers, but a weekly Dvar Torah. And earlier in his career, some of his weekly Dvar Torah took the liberty and the license in a literary style of depicting our Avos and Imahos in a very casual, comfortable way, in a very contemporary way. And it elicited great criticism of him. So for example, here's a Dvar Torah he wrote on Parshas Chayei Sarah, where he's talking about, and I don't want to get into it in depth, I'm just giving it to you as a sort of mara makom. And he says, there's a seemingly extra word in our portion this week opens up the possibility of what he calls a modern medrash, and a daring comment. So even in his introduction, Rabbi Riskin is already acknowledging that what he's going to say is daring, and he calls it a modern medrash, which I see on social media all the time, people now authoring their own modern medrashim, and I'm not sure if that's an oxymoron. I don't know how the terminology works of a modern, the authority of a medrash is its authorship and the time in which it was written. And I can't write a modern daf of Gemara. I can't offer a modern Maimar Chazal because I thought of a great quip. But yet this is a term that's now entered our lexicon, a modern medrash and a daring comment. And what is Rabbi Riskin's suggestion here? He wonders, when Avram Avinu returns from the Akedah and he finds that Sarah, of course we know the story, she died literally, it said on her death certificate, what was her cause of death? She was scared to death. She heard that her husband took her only son on top of a mountain and was prepared to slit his throat. And we learn from here, Chazal learned from here, when you have to tell someone news, if you have children, you've learned this also, how to tell your parents. I want to tell you, first of all, that your granddaughter's fine. But listen to what happened to her at school today. She fell off the playground and she broke her leg and she had to take it in an ambulance. But you start out, you learn from Sarah, you start out and you say, I want you to know everything's fine. Nothing to worry about. Everything's fine. But listen to this crazy story. Because if you start out, you know, your granddaughter was on the playground today. She fell off. She broke her leg. Ambulance came. It was unclear what would happen. You may not get to finish the story because you give the person on the other end of the line a heart attack. So we learn from here. Sarah had expired. So asks Rabbi Riskin, what is Sarah doing where she is? Sarah died in Kiryat Arba, which is Hebron, and Avram came to eulogize her. And he wonders, if Avram came from where he had lived with Sarah and Yitzchak before the Akedah, that was Beersheba. So what is Sarah doing in Hebron? And Rabbi Riskin offers a very daring comment. He suggests that Avram and Sarah were separated. I don't know if they were divorced. They were separated. And why were they separated? Turn the page. Sarah, follow the underlines. Sarah, however, saw the side of Avram the public never got to see. The great teacher who often had no time for his own wife and child. Often this God-inspired, magnetic, and extroverted personality seemed to take those closest to him for granted. When they were younger and famine forced them to travel to Egypt, Avram concealed Sarah's identity, and so on. He goes on, and maybe this is more autobiographical on Rabbi Riskin's part, and he's just transferring onto Avraham. I think many rabbis, community leaders, can identify with this dilemma. And that's the suggestion he has at the end. Avraham, of course, doesn't heed Sarah. The last word she cries to him as he disappears in the distance is, "When you get back, don't think I'll be here waiting for you." That's a daring comment. Another example of a daring comment from Rabbi Riskin, turn the page, is a Dvar Torah he had dealing with Yosef. He writes, "When the time comes to marry, the Grand Vizier of Egypt never even considers returning to his homeland and seek a wife from his people. He marries instead Osnas, the daughter of a pagan priest. Yosef is now Tzofnas Paneach, and perhaps not that different from Joanne, what does that say? Bursky becoming Lauren Bacall, or Isidore Dembski polishing his image into Kirk Douglas. If it's true in Hollywood, Washington, and Wall Street, why should it be any different in Nile country? Joseph is truly successful, assimilated Jew. Richer than Kissinger," and he goes on and on. And you see that he's speaking in a very casual, contemporary way. Well, Rabbi Riskin was highly criticized for this approach. And in fact, it came to a head, I believe, historically, when he was slated to speak in a shul in London, England. This goes back numerous decades. And when he arrived to speak, there was a rally outside. By a segment of the community, he took offense to the style in which he was writing about the Avos and Imos. There was a protest, a rally, an objection to Rabbi Riskin speaking. And that led to him authoring this short pamphlet. The pamphlet's called, I have a copy of it, "Conflicts Within the Family, Confessions of a Biblical Commentator. The Rights and Wrongs of Individual Interpretations of Biblical Exegesis." We're now on page 3. And in this short pamphlet, it's not long, Rabbi Riskin first defends each of his comments. And he does, I think, a very compelling job. He shows and traces throughout Maimar Chazal, Rishonim, and Achronim, great rabbis throughout the millennia who took the license and liberty to offer criticism of the Avos and Imos. And he shows precedent for some of the opinions and the daring comments that he made. However, he concludes, and this I'll read with you on the right-hand column on page 3, he writes, "Having explained the basis of the various commentaries which engendered controversy, I must admit that I have learned a great deal from the voices raised in protest. The earlier pieces which appeared over my signature on Joseph, for example, had not actually been written by me. They were reworkings of oral lectures I had given. And in retrospect, I believe that the style of writing which emerged lacked a properly respectful tone for the great personages under discussion. I've learned that the oral word cannot simply be transcribed and submitted as a written text. After all, not everything that one thinks ought one say, not everything that one says ought one write, not everything that one writes ought one publish. This is especially true when a ghostwriter adds comparisons to movie screen characters of questionable character. I apologize for and retract these pieces and have already stopped using such a method of transcription." So Rabbi Riskin, on the one hand, makes a compelling argument for taking liberty to see imperfection of the Avos and Imos. That's what the rest of the booklet is. But the postscript is, he acknowledges that even when taking such liberty, one has to be vigilant and exceedingly cautious to speak about our Avos and Imos and all of our great personages in deferential terms, with great reverence, with great awe, and with great respect. Number 2, an article by Rabbi Emanuel Feldman. This appeared in Jewish Action magazine many years ago. It's called "A Storied Life." And here Rabbi Emanuel Feldman, formerly the rabbi of Atlanta, Georgia, formerly editor of the of Tradition Journal, a great rabbi, somebody who I greatly admire. Rabbi Emanuel Feldman writes an article where he is observing and sharing his insight into a new genre of literature which has burst onto the Jewish scene. And the new genre of literature is called hagiography, or, he describes it, gadolography. Gadolography is a genre of literature where we write about our Gedolei Yisrael, our greatest rabbis, and they're not true biographies, because a true biography tells the good, the bad, and the ugly. A true biography tries to capture accurately, historically, the life, the challenges, the ups, the downs of the person. Our Gedolah books don't even aspire to do that. I'm not sure they even claim to do that, but they certainly don't accomplish that. You read the typical Gedolah book, and this is what Rabbi Feldman bemoans here. If you look on the bottom paragraph on the left-hand column, "We learn all about a Gedolah's dazzling scholarship, but how was he as a father, a husband, or teacher? He was obviously a very angelic person. In what ways was he human as well? Was he constantly engaged in study and acts of chesed? Or did other matters occupy him as well? Was he gregarious, or did he live an isolated existence?" These books depict, they finish Shas, before they emerged from the womb, and they gave enormous tzedakah even though they lived in poverty, and they had time for everyone even though they never stopped learning for a moment, and they depict a life which is simply unrealistic, unattainable, it's impossible. And Rabbi Feldman's thesis is that by depicting such a life of perfection, infallibility, the bar set so high, we can't really learn from them in the sense that we could emulate them. All we can do is admire them from a distance, but not feel that their life can inspire ours as well. And that's his observation about this new genre, and it's worthwhile to talk about that, but that's not why I share his article. The reason I share his article is the next page. Because he then gets into, to bring support for his position, which is that we have nothing to apologize for when we tell the truth about our gedolim. When we are honest about the lives they led, the hardship, disappointments, failures, shortcomings, we are not diminishing their stature in any way. We're making them accessible. We're elevating their stature because we can then seek to become more like them. And the evidence he brings for the legitimacy to do that is exactly our question: how we interpret the lives of the Avos and Imos. So now we're on page 5, and look on the left-hand column. Agenda-driven stories that are devoid of content, combined with biographies that are short on objectivity and long on reverential awe, combine to create a new genre that cannot be taken seriously by anyone but the most naive and credulous. He says it a little harsher than I. There are stories, and there are stories. The story of Yosef and his brothers, the longest sustained narrative in the entire Torah, is obviously more than a mere story. As part of Torah, it is more than narrative, and its multi-layered structure illuminates and instructs in ways that we cannot fathom. But at the very least, it contains critical lessons for living, and it does this by painting a full picture of its protagonists. To view it merely as good literature would be to denigrate. But even on the most elementary level, the narrative, with its light and shadows, positives and negatives, is uplifting precisely because it's multi-hued, uncompromising, and unrelenting in its honesty. This is now the paragraph I draw your attention to, the middle column. One shudders to think how it would be written today. Would any contemporary religious writer dare mention that Joseph in his youth was concerned with his physical appearance? Which Rashi does. As for Jacob's favoring one son over another, would not our writer gloss over that inconvenient fact? Would Yosef's talebearing be omitted as well as the jealousy of the brothers? Would not the story of Yehuda and Tamar be excised because it might offend, as would the story of Yosef and the wife of Potiphar? And the slaughter of the inhabitants of Shechem is so unbecoming the sons of Yaakov that it might best be eluded. The actual hurling of Yosef into the pit and his subsequent sale into slavery, would this not cast an unflattering and cruel light on the brothers and be expurgated from the story? In today's gadolography, we would be treated only to the bare-bones information that Yosef, whom Yaakov loved very much, mysteriously disappeared, causing Yaakov great anguish, did not appear till 22 years later as viceroy of Egypt. He would be told. Never lost hope, since he was a great tzaddik, and Yosef, also a great tzaddik like his father, always knew someday he would see his father again. And when, because of the great famine, Yaakov went down to Egypt, he finally was reunited with his son and lived happily ever after in Goshen until he died at the ripe old age of 147. Right? You have to love Rabbi Feldman's censored, sterilized version. The parsha, the whole narrative of Yosef, wouldn't take several parshios. We could finish it in one aliyah. We'll cut out the parts that are hard to understand if they're perfect, and we'll just read it that way. What's striking about the real Yosef, he writes, is that we emerge from it not only deeply stirred, but also with a keen understanding of human nature, of ourselves, and most significantly, of our own relationship to man and God. So he's using the imperfections that the Torah itself chooses to depict as the evidence that we are not supposed to hold our gedolim to a standard of perfection. Not only is it okay, but we stand to grow even more when we have access to their imperfections. Well, this article by Rabbi Emanuel Feldman on the next page, page 6, elicited a letter to the editor by Rabbi Nissen Wolpin, the editor of the Jewish Observer, Olav HaSholom. Jewish Observer was the magazine of the Agudas Yisrael. So the Jewish Observer, Rabbi Nissen Wolpin, the editor, writes in, and he takes umbrage. He's offended by Rabbi Feldman's depiction. And he writes, where I underlined, of greater significance and of utmost sensitivity, once we draw parallels between Yosef's internecine conflicts and our squabbles, we inevitably equate him with us. Joseph's tale-bearing, the jealousy of our brothers, would be just another case of sibling rivalry, even though I'm confident that Rabbi Feldman would never mean us to view it as anything of the sort. My teachers and mentors, writes Rabbi Wolpin, constantly underscored the vast gulf that separates us from the Shvatim, as from all personalities of Tanakh, as no doubt that the teachers and mentors of Rabbi Feldman. Skip down to the next underline. We dare not risk belittling the like of Yosef and his brothers by equating them with us in any fashion. So Rabbi Wolpin took offense or took some exception to the way in which Rabbi Feldman was describing the unsterilized version of the Yosef story that we have versus how it would appear today if certain publishing houses were to publish the Gadolography of Yosef HaTzadik. I mean, could you imagine? It's actually an interesting exercise. Could you imagine, I'm not going to mention the name of any Jewish publishing house, they've all done wonderful work and had made great contributions to the Jewish people. I think people are quick to criticize them and try to dismiss them. They're all wonderful. But could you imagine if you charged any of them and said, Feldheim, Artsgrill, Mosaic, I don't know all the presses, write a biography of Yosef HaTzadik. Could they sell it? Could children read it? Would they be allowed to read it? Anyway, Rabbi Feldman responds to Rabbi Wolpin's letter. He says, the responses to my essay indicate a nerve was touched. And he goes to the third paragraph. I have no disagreement with Rabbi Wolpin on the major parameters of the subject. In fact, the idea that Torah is not mere literature, our patriarchs are not to be treated with limiting measuring rods of ordinary mortals, are the very concepts I tried to teach my congregants through decades of sermons. So he says, of course I agree. The Avos and Imos are categorically different. They're not like you and me. We should not talk about them casually. But the fact that they're different doesn't mean that they're perfect. And he continues on the next page. We're on page 7 now. Perhaps our disagreement lies in our respective reading of the well-known dictum of the sages. Ein mikra yotze midei pshuta. The Gemara in Shabbos Samach Gimel. A verse does not lose its simple meaning. Chazal wanted us to understand that while it's true there are multiple layers and levels of interpretation, you can approach Chumash or Tanakh with Pardes, Pshat, Remez, Drash, Sod. You can approach it with the famous statement, Shivim Panim LaTorah, there's 70 interpretations. There's a multiplicity of approaches to Torah. But yet, Chazal emphasize, and some of the Rishonim dedicate their entire Perush according to this principle, that Ein Mikra Yotzei Midei Pshuto. That in the end of the day, those are additional layers. But the additional layers never supplant or replace the original simple meaning. So if the Torah tells us that Yosef looked in the mirror, that Yosef was tempted and seduced, that Yosef didn't get along with his brothers, we can reinterpret or offer further interpretation, but it can never purge or replace the original simple interpretation. Ein mikra yotze midei pshuto. What occurred in the biblical narrative, I'm back in Rabbi Feldman's response, what occurred in the biblical narratives on the visible macro level is true in accordance with how Torah Shabbat Peh explains it. In this view, the forefathers were spiritual giants who were never motivated by mundane or ordinary concerns, as the simple meaning of the text might occasionally lead us to believe. Nevertheless, the simple meaning of the text informs us that at least on some elementary level, these spiritual giants also had certain mundane concerns. For if this were not so on the micro level, then the Torah would not have permitted the simple meaning of the verse to have given this impression. Because Ein Mikra Yotzei Midei Pshuto. So if it allows us to have that impression, it's by design. It's with intent. It's not coincidental. So yes, we add layers of interpretation. And yes, we maintain awe and reverence and we see them as categorically different. But we don't have to try to twist ourselves in a pretzel to deny the simple meaning and what it depicts. And he continues. It is thus evident that we can indeed take the Torah as our model in writing biographies of great Jews. If the Torah teaches us that the forefathers were not perfect creatures, then we too, in presenting the life stories of contemporary great Jews, who are certainly not of the stature of our biblical giants, should not feel it necessary to conceal any shortcomings if this helps instruct and inspire. That's what he's encouraging among our Gedolim. On page 8, the Jewish Observer in 1991 reprinted a letter, a protest, from Avraham Kotler Zatzal, that first appeared in Warsaw's Der Yiddische Tagblatt, I never subscribed to that, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, Poland's only religious daily newspaper. It first appeared by Avraham Kotler on April 16th, 1935. And why did Avraham Kotler feel, Avraham Kotler, I don't know how old he was at 1935, already a prominent Talmud Chacham, a Talmud of Slobodka, and he feels a need to, in this Polish newspaper, offer a protest. What led Rav Aaron Kotler to issue this protest? So let's read.
It was recently shown the last few issues of the newspaper Heint. How shocked I was to see the terrible blasphemies, the violation of the sanctity of our holy patriarchs and matriarchs that they contained. The laws of our holy Torah obligate me to react to this unheard of profanation of truth. Chilul Shem Shemayim in violation of the dignity of the Jewish nation. I thus feel compelled to depart from my usual practice and to issue the following public statement. And what's the issue? The public statement is that the Avos and Imos are perfect. Don't question them. Don't speak casually about them. Don't undermine them. If you do, it is an enormous Chilul Hashem that he feels a Torah mandate to stand up and to protest. You can read the rest of his letter later. Page 9. This question, do we have to see our greatest leaders as perfect, or can we see them as imperfect and maybe they're even greater because of or despite of their imperfections? It's a question that doesn't only exist regarding the Avos and Imos, but as Rabbi Thelman said, it's a question that speaks to the broader issue of how we look at Gedolim, how we look at history itself. Rav Shimon Schwab Zatzal, the great leader of the German Jewish community, Washington Heights, Breuer's community. Rav Schwab has an article on Jewish history. This too was first published in the Mittelungen, another, how do you pronounce it? Mittelungen? Your Umma would have been able to pronounce it, but I can't. So I also don't subscribe to that. It was published December, March 1984, 1985. It appears in Rav Schwab's book, Selected Writings. And in this article, Rabbi Schwab is addressing the question of history. How should Jews learn history? Should we expose our children and ourselves to unadulterated, unfiltered, unsterilized views of history? Or do we purify history? We run it through a filter before we share it with our children or even read it ourselves. And his launching point is the story of Hanukkah. And he asks, why did our Chachamim not leave us an account of the glory and the final decay of the Maccabees? We have to glean almost every little bit from secular sources. A few sprinklings here and there are preserved for us in the words of Chazal. Why didn't Chazal see it as a priority to tell us the whole story and the aftermath of the story? Why didn't Chazal author history books alongside their legal books? We have Shas, and Shas is filled with Halacha and Agada. And the Agada is to inspire us, it's Musar. It's insight, it's machshava, but we don't have, really, we have sections, but we don't have elaborate history. Why not? Why wasn't history a priority to Chazal? Question goes much further, writes Rav Schwab. We have no authentic description by our Tanaim of the period of the Churban, of the Jewish war against the Romans, the destruction of the Jewish state, the revolt and downfall of Bar Kokhba, except for a few Agadic sayings in Talmud and Medrash. For our historical knowledge, we rely on the renegade Josephus Flavius, who was a friend of Rome and a traitor to his people. So most of what we know at that time that we can't glean or extrapolate from the Medrash and Chazal is Josephus. Josephus was a traitor to our people. He's our authority. Where were Chazal? Why didn't Chazal record history? Come to think of it, since the close of Tanakh, says Rav Schwab, the beginning of the second Beis HaMikdash, we have no Jewish history but composed by our soul from Tanaim and Amoraim. The prophets and the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah recorded all the events of their day as well as previous periods. When prophecy ceased, the recording of Jewish history stopped. Where did it go? Why do we not have an authoritative, authentic Jewish history? And says Rav Schwab, something that you might find very shocking. But it's a philosophy. It's a legitimate approach. He writes in the bottom of the page, there's a vast difference between history and storytelling. History must be truthful. Otherwise, it does not deserve its name. A book of history must report the bad with the good, the ugly, the beautiful, the difficulties, the victories, the guilt, the virtue. Since it is supposed to be truthful, it cannot spare the righteous if he fails, and it cannot skip the virtues of the villain. Such is truth. All is told the way it happened. Only a Navi mandated by his divine calling has the ability to report history as it really happened, unbiased and without prejudice. Says Rav Schwab, this is incredible, we no longer care about history. Because to have the accurate angle on history, you have to have prophecy. Every history includes editorializing. Historians try to be objective, but they can't help have opinions and personalities and tastes and inclinations, predispositions, and they try as hard as they can to keep it out of the record of history, but it can't help to sneak in. So to have true history, posits Rav Schwab, you need to have nevuah. God has to dictate the accurate record of history. And once nevuah was closed, history is closed. So we don't have history. What do we as a people have? Storytelling. And what's the goal of storytelling? To motivate, to inspire. History needs to be accurate. Storytelling can be flexible. History has to tell the whole story. Storytelling can choose to only say what you want to say to achieve your goal. History has no license. Storytelling has some literary license, and so on and so forth. Sort of Schwab's position is that we no longer concern ourselves with recording, reviewing, studying history. We are a people of storytelling, and we are entitled to tell the story the way we want to achieve the goals the way we want. So what good, says Rav Schwab, are, and he's not writing about hagiographies, it came after his time, but he's defending hagiographies. And he's saying, these are not historical biographies. These are storytelling biographies. Historical biographies would have to tell the good, the bad, and the ugly, but storytelling biographies are entitled to only include the sections that will inspire people in the way they want. So this question, which we're now going to go even more in depth into, of the attitude we bring towards the Avos and Imos and the way we read Chumash itself, is not only focused in a narrow sense on Chumash, but is our attitude to the study of history itself and how we look up at and how we view our Gedolim. I didn't put it in the source sheets. It might be too shocking to you, even. We had a great rabbi a few centuries ago, Rav Yaakov Emden. Rav Yaakov Emden, Rabbi J.J. Schachter, is the world's authority on Rav Yaakov Emden, not just the Emden-Eibschitz controversy, but Rav Yaakov Emden itself. Rabbi Schachter, Rabbi Dr. Schachter, did his PhD on Rav Yaakov Emden. And he has a thesis that's like 800 pages long, and I have a copy of it. It's fascinating. It includes in it a translation of Rav Yaakov Emden's autobiography, which Rabbi Schachter has not published, because he would likely be put in cheirim and accused of all kinds of manipulation if he revealed what's in Rav Yaakov Emden's autobiography. So I'll tell you one story in it, which I even blushed to share with you in front of the Aron Kodesh, but I'll tell you not because I want to diminish. You have to understand who Rav Yaakov Emden was. Rav Yaakov Emden was an extraordinary Talmud Chacham, community leader. He had a rivalry with Rav Yonasan Eibschitz, not only on the question of Shabtai Tzvi, but Rav Yonasan Eibschitz landed a rabbinic position that he had wanted. There's a whole history to it that you don't need to hear from me. But Rav Yaakov Emden is such a great gadol b'halacha, you can't turn a page of Mishnah Brura without him quoting Rav Yaakov Emden on every page of the Mishnah Brura. And yet Rav Yaakov Emden describes in his autobiography that at one point he was not in the rabbinate, he was a personal Talmud Chacham, and he had a printing press in his basement, which Rabbi Schachter points out was one of the great challenges in his life, because it meant anytime he had a thought about Rabbi Yonasan Eibschitz, all he had to do was go down to the basement and he could mass produce that thought. If he had to actually go to a publisher and he had to coordinate and he had to print it, it's a precursor to how careful we should be about email. The things we do on email, if you had to sit down with a pen and paper and fold it and find the envelope and look for the stamp and make it to the post office, by the time in between each of those steps, 15 times you would have said, you know what, I probably shouldn't be sending this letter. Instead, in a moment, we write it on the end, we press send on the email and it's out, and they say, you know what, maybe I shouldn't have sent that email, but it's too late. But anyway, Rav Yaakov Emden, extraordinary Talmud Chacham. He's traveling for Parnassah, and he describes that he's away from home for a series of months. And he says it's very hard for him. It's very hard for him, apropos our conference call tonight. It's very hard for him. He has no intimacy. So he describes in his autobiography that there was a young woman who admired him. And he had engaged in a relationship with her, an appropriate relationship with her. And he writes in the autobiography that he considered and she would have agreed to go to the mikvah, which would enable him to be with her without any gross violation. And he had a whole halachic justification because he was far from her. And he decided not to in the end. He persevered and he overcame and he determined it was inappropriate and he didn't. And he didn't. So I share that story with you. Do you think less of Rav Yaakov Emden or do you think more? To me, I say Rav Yaakov Emden was a human being, was a man. He had needs. He was struggling, he was tempted, and wow, he overcame that temptation. And he even had the courage, wisely or unwisely, to share the story of his temptation and how he overcame it. It doesn't diminish his esteem in my eyes, it raises it. I can look up to him even more. So this is this debate about hagiography, gadolography, which stems from this debate about the attitude we have towards our avos and imos. So a few examples of it in our limited time left, which Rabbi Simon still hasn't told me how much time I have. When a minion of people fall asleep, that's when you have to stop. Okay, so top of page 11. And these are among now, those were all articles, now we're into the sources. This is Tenuos on Musar, quoting Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, Rabbi Feldman referenced it earlier. Lo ko masha choshim yesh lahavia, lo ko masha vivim yesh lachtov, lo ko masha kosim yesh lahadfis. This is a great motto to live by. Not everything you think do you need to say. And not everything you say do you need to write. And not everything you write do you need to publish. That's a great motto for email and social media and a great attitude and perspective for life. And that's what Rabbi Feldman was talking about earlier when it came. Here in Mishnah's Rabbi Aaron, Chelek Gimel, source number 2. This is Rav Aaron Kotler, not the protest he issued in the Polish newspaper, but here he's writing too about this question. Kishenigashim l'ini Yishmael v'Yitzchak. When you approach the question of the rivalry of Yishmael and Yitzchak, and you do so with the perspective of an ordinary person, you might mistake, and this is Zinyana Dioma, the parashios we're reading now, you might look at the rivalry of Sarah and Hagar, of Yishmael and Yitzchak, and say, you know, this was just petty rivalry between two women. This was two women playing mahjong. My son's smarter. No, my son's smarter. Mine's more accomplished. No, mine's more accomplished. And that's all this was. Aser lahalo zos ala das umachshava zui kfira mamish. Says Rav Aaron Kotler, chalila, you should dismiss their conflict as a mere rivalry. And to do so, to see them as human, to see them as similar to who we are, says Rav Aaron Kotler, Zukfira mamish, it's heresy. Obviously, a word we don't or shouldn't throw around lightly. Zegamlo miskabel al asichel kier kodesh baruch hu tziyulav l'shmol kol sara. He says, not only is it heresy, moreover, it's untenable. Because in the end of the day, Hashem weighs in. When you're playing mahjong, to the best of my ability, no one's ever heard a baskol announce whose son actually is more accomplished. But here, Hashem tells Avram, everything Sarah says, Shema Bikola, listen to her. Ubistam Tigra bin Shtei Noshin, Vayakadosh Baruch Hu Mitzavizos. And in a petty rivalry, Hashem wouldn't weigh in. Ubichlal Maisa Avos, Shekvisha Amarno, Yisodos, Labinin Ami Srova, Olam Kulo, Lo Yuchlu, Lios, Mushpoim, Mashpa, Koshi, Mutios, Ritzonos, Atzmiim. Says Rav Aaron Kotler the following. We all have a sense of ego, a sense of self. And that dictates and drives many of our decisions and who we are. Says Rav Aaron Kotler, the Avos and Imos had no ego. Zero. They had no personal sense of self. No personal sense of legacy. No personal sense of honor or name. Everything they did was kulo entirely lios mushpoim ashpa koshi mintios ritzonos atzmiim. All they wanted to do was to build and shape the nation that was going to continue from them. They negated entirely any sense of self, so as to see in them imperfection, to see in them ego, to see in them honor, to see in them principle, didn't exist. It's not who they were. And to transfer it onto them, says Rav Aaron Kotler, is an act of heresy. Ilo haya pegam koshu ba'avos, v'yeza pegam dak min adak, haysa kol metzius am Yisrael acheres. And he says, moreover, if it were true that there were any deficiency in the avos and imos, it would trickle down. You know, it's like, he doesn't give this example, but it's like DNA. If there's a chromosomal abnormality in an earlier generation, it will affect all the subsequent generations who will carry that chromosomal abnormality. And forever that family will be different. If Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah were in fact deficient spiritually, all of Am Yisrael, Klal Yisrael would be different. They were perfect. They built our nation on the foundation of their perfection. Chalila, anyone should ascribe to them anything other than perfection. And to do so, says Rav Aaron Kotler, is kfira. Rav Dessler also echoes the sentiment. Michta Melo Chelek Gimel, source number 3. They achieved a level of clinging to Hashem with no barrier, with no temptation, with no distraction. Their entire life was perfection. They achieved veikus with the Ribon Shalom. Similar to Rav Aaron Cutler. They had no individuality. There was no sense of self. They were entirely given over to the building of the Jewish people and to Hashem. Again, to ascribe any shortcoming, deficiency, any interpersonal struggle is nothing short of kfira. Rav Chaim David Halevi, in his Tshuvos Aseh L'Charav, also deals with this question. Very interesting. He's asked, and he writes back to the person, he says, you know, Michtavcha, your letter, Miyom Chav Beis Kislev, Garam Litzar Amok. The letter you sent me caused me great pain. You never want to get a letter back from a chief rabbi, from a great Talmud Chacham that says, your letter caused me great pain. Not the opening to the letter you want to get back. Why? Mishum Sha'ata Adam Dati. You're supposed to be a religious Jew. And how do I know that? Because you wrote in the upper right-hand corner of your letter, B'siyata D'shmaya. Me'olam lo ha'isi ma'ala adaiti she'adam dati yakif b'charifas kezos u'bituyim botim ka'ela es avos ha'uma ha'malchia. A religious Jew like you who writes B'siyata D'shmaya on your letter would talk in such denigrating, casual terms, such critical terms of the avos and imos? Can't be. Adam chiloni, okay, a person who's not religious could be so cynical? Maybe. But you could talk about them in that way? How could it be? And he goes through Rav Chaim David Halevi. Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu spoke about our avos and imos, and the nevuah that they attained. Ketzer Allah adait chalatiach dvarim kobotim akashim negdom, achri shezaku she'elokim atzmo diber itam v'nish balem. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu talks about Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov as loyal, trusted servants and children and part of his inner chamber and the person he loves and adores. Hashem talks about them in glowing terms, and you, some schnook, you write B'siyata D'shmaya, you think you're allowed to talk about Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov however you want? Chalila! Chalila. So that's the one perspective. Rav Aaron Cutler, Rav Dessler, Rav Chaim David Halevi, we saw Rav Schwab, Rav Nissen Wolpin, and so on. But now I want to share with you the other side and bring you evidence and examples of the other side. Most prominent among them is Rav Hirsch. Source number 5, page 12. Says Rav Hirsch, the Torah never hides from us the faults, errors, and weaknesses of our great men. Hear how different that is than what we just read? The Torah never hides from us the faults, errors, and weaknesses of our great men. Just by that it gives the stamp of veracity to what it relates. But in truth, by the knowledge which is given us of their faults and weaknesses, our great men are in no wise made lesser, but actually greater and more instructive. If they stood before us as the purest models of perfection, we should attribute them as having a different nature, which has been denied to us. So if you tell me that Rav Avadya Yosef Zatzal had a memory? Photographic memory. So he remembered everything he ever saw, and that's why he was an enormous Talmud Chacham, brilliant mind, encyclopedic mind. I say, that's nice. I can't remember what I had for breakfast this morning. So he and I must be parts of different species, and there's nothing about his life that can be a model for me, because we're part of two different species of human beings, of creation. That's what Rav Hirsch is saying. Were they without passion, without internal struggles, their virtues would seem to us the outcome of some higher nature, hardly a merit and certainly no model that we could hope to emulate. Take, for instance, Moshe Zanava. Did we not know that he could also fly into a passion? His meekness and modesty would seem to us to be his inborn natural disposition, and lost to us as an example. Right? So Moshe flies off the handle. You'll excuse me for using that language in this talk where we're saying you shouldn't use that language. But take when he hits the rock. The Rambam says it was an act of kas. Rav Hirsch says, Shimu na hamorim. He yells at the people. He's incredulous with the people. He's frustrated with the people. Flies off with anger towards the people. Would you picture somebody like that would also be the most humble man that ever lived? In other words, if we didn't know the story of when he lost it with the rock, you might think, okay, he's humble. That's the way he's born. That's his makeup. That's how he is. That's his innate character. But because we know he's the capacity for passion and anger, it makes the fact that he was the most humble man of all time even more meaningful, even more of a model. Torah also shows us no faults without at the same time letting us see the greater or lesser evil consequence. From our great teachers of the Torah, truly Ramban can be reckoned among the greatest, we would accordingly learn that it may never be our task to whitewash the spiritual and moral heroes of our past, to appear as apologists for them. They do not require our apologies, nor do such attempts become them. Truth is the seal of the Torah, and truthfulness is the principle of all its true and great commentators and teachers. All this, if we would have to say with Ramban, Chata Avram Avinu Chat Gadol Bishkaga. The Ramban's not afraid to say Avram sinned, we'll see it in a moment, and so is Rav Hirsch. Okay, so Rav Hirsch represents the other side of this question and debate, which absolutely they were human. Absolutely they were mere mortals. Absolutely they were imperfect. Does that make them just like us? No. They're still great, great, great men and women, categorically different. But they were human. And it's in their humanity that we find inspiration. So Rav Hirsch writes in source, the next source, page 12, as I repeatedly remarked, we follow the opinion of our sages. We do not consider our task to be apologists for our great men and women. Just as the word of God, the Torah itself, never refrains from informing us of their errors and weaknesses. If Rivka brought it about that Yaakov deceived his father, it says quite unequivocally that Ba'achicha b'mirma, Reb Chanina expresses himself about the events recorded in this chapter as follows. Anyone who says that God is not so particular with his pious ones, that frum people need not be so particular in certain directions, deserves to have his inwards torn out. The forbearance of God grants long credit, but the debt is to be paid in the end. One cry Yaakov caused Esav to make, and that was repaid in Shushan, when Esav's descendants caused Yaakov's descendant. So in other words, Yaakov lied. You can say it was a justified lie. You can say truth is relative, not absolute. You can give a lot of perushim. What you can't say is, Yaakov never told a lie. You can't do it, because Chazal hold him to task for it. If quite thoughtful considerations of this event force one to conclusions that would remove a great deal of its bitterness, we do not think we should refrain from giving them in order to avoid our appearance as apologists. Enough will still remain which cannot be approved of, especially when measured with the yardstick of character of a nation whose name is Yishurun. So the first year is writing about Yaakov lying to his father Yitzchak. He says, the Jewish people are supposed to be a nation of honesty. How do you reconcile it? Okay, we can work on it. But we have to begin with the question. You can't start it off by saying, he didn't really lie, it wasn't a lie, here's why it wasn't a lie, it was a lie. Now you have to figure out why in that circumstance it was okay to lie, but you cannot deny that it was a lie. That is Rav Hirsch. Rav Hutner Zatzal, the next page, has a famous letter in his Igros Uksovim. He has a famous letter, Kuf Chaf Ches, to one of his students. And he writes in this letter, we're not going to read the whole thing, it's already getting late, but he writes in the letter, it's a student who's despondent. The student has despair. The student writes to Rav Hutner, the Rosh Hashiva of Chaim Berlin, the author of Pachad Yitzchak, or the one who gave the shiurim that are recorded in Pachad Yitzchak. And the student says to Rav Hutner, you know, I'm giving up on learning. I'm unsuccessful. I have struggles. I have temptations. I keep falling. Even if I try to get up, what's the point of it all? I'll never be anything. And Rav Hutner writes back the most beautiful letter where he tells him, no, you don't understand. I know that there's a sad mistake that there's a move to depict our Avos and Imos, there's a move to depict our Gedolei Yisrael as if they never had shortcomings. But they did struggle and fight through those struggles and persevere. Because when you do, that's when you can attain godless. There's a little translation of a part of the letter there on the bottom of page 13. He writes, our trouble is that when we are engrossed in the facets of wholesomeness of our greats, we deal with the completed form of their qualities and skip over the inner struggle that transpired in their spirit. The impression left by our talks about the great leaders makes it seem as if they issued from the hand of the Creator in their full stature and stance. Everyone speaks as and is moved by the example of the purity of the tongue of the author of Chafetz Chaim. But who knows, say one in a thousand, about all the wars, the struggles, the failures, the falls, the regressions the Chafetz Chaim encountered in his path of fighting with his evil inclination. Who knows? We know the Chafetz Chaim never spoke Lashon Hara. Was he born not speaking Lashon Hara? Did that take effort? Did that take time? And now I close with a few examples of Chazal not hesitating to be critical and some of our Mefarshim who are critical, now that we've laid out the two schools of thought. First of all, Source 8 is Gemara. We're going to go through it quickly. Source 8 is Gemara in Sanhedrin Daf Mem Vav, which tells us, Gemara says, Toshma, Mideikvur Tzadiki, Come and learn from the fact that righteous people are buried. Why are righteous people buried? The Gemara there is having a discussion. What's the purpose of burial? Is the purpose of burial to avoid bizayon, or does it achieve kapara? Why does the body have to be interred in the ground and endure the being food for the local residents under the ground? Is it because it's a bizayon? What else will you do with the body? Or is it somehow a kapara? And the Gemara says, well, look, let's look. The righteous, the avos and imos are buried. So you see, it's kapara. So, yeah, amarti mishum kapara, tzadike le kapara, tzrichi. Do the avos and imos need a kapara? They need atonement? Why would they have to be buried? Why do we have a maris machpelah and a kever rachel? Says the Gemara, yeah, in. Tichsiv adam ein tzadik ba'aretz asher yasa tov v'lo yecheta. The Gemara quotes a pasuk. We know that there's no one who is so righteous in the world that they are perfect and they've never made a mistake. Nobody. Nobody. So therefore, yeah, even tzaddikim need burial because even they need kapara because nobody can be described as absolutely perfect. And the Gemara employs this term in a story with Rabbi Akiva there in source number 9, later in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, on Daf Kuf Aleph. Let's turn the page. Page 15. Source 12. I mentioned earlier, Rabbi Shmuel, Debei Rabbi Shmuel, Tana, Ukapatish Yefotze Sala, like a hammer shatters a rock, Ma Patish Zem Ischalak L'Kama Nitzotas Af Nikra Echad Yotzeh L'Kama Ta'amim. Just like a hammer shatters a rock and the shards of the rock is a million pieces of the rock, so too we have the capacity to analyze and approach a pasuk and to extrapolate, to yield many, many different teachings. How many teachings? The Medrash says, Shivim Panim LaTorah, there are 70 faces to Torah. Source 13 is the Gemara in Shabbos that we saw earlier from Rabbi Feldman, Ein Mikra Yotzeh Midei Pshuto, that even when you have additional layers, the Gemara in Sanhedrin says, you smack it with the hammer, many, many shards. We have many, many layers of Torah interpretation, but nevertheless, the layers are on top of, they complement, they never replace the original meaning, the simple meaning, Ein Mikra Yotzeh Midei Pshuto. Source 14 is the Medrash Rabbah. When Yaakov Avinu says, Al Nasik Bereini B'Mitzrayim, don't bury me in Egypt. There's this obsession. Yosef doesn't want to be buried in Egypt. Yaakov doesn't want to be buried in Egypt. Why doesn't Yaakov want to be buried in Egypt, says the Medrash? Nema bikesh Yaakov Avinu shelo yikaver b'Mitzrayim, shelo yasu oso avodas kochavim. Why did Yaakov not want to be buried in Egypt? Because he was fearful. The whole time Yaakov lived in Egypt, there was prosperity on his account. The people would have such admiration and awe, such reverence, they would come to his grave to worship as if he were perfect. Even our avos never wanted to be depicted in a perfect fashion. The Gemara itself is not afraid to criticize. Source 15, the Gemara in Nedarim Lamed Beis. Amar b'Yavo, Amar b'Lazer. M'neman ne'nash Avram Avinu. Why was Avram punished? What was the punishment? Shnishtabdu banav l'mitzrayim asayim ve'eser shanim. We were his punishment. That we spent 210 years in Mitzrayim. Ibnei she'asa angariya b'talmidei chachamim. Why? He conscripted Torah scholars in the war. In the battle of the four kings and the five kings, he had students, he had set them up in a base medrash, he had disciples, the nefesh asher asu b'charon, and he said to them, look, there's a battle, four kings, five kings, my nephew's involved, no, everyone close your gemara, get up from your shtender, come, we're going to fight. This is a gemara that's often quoted, we're not going to talk about it now, but the whole tzav gius, the question about whether you should have an exemption from the Israeli army if you're learning in yeshiva, this is one of the gemaras, as you can imagine, that's quoted. To which the response is, this is agarita, this is not halacha. But there's a debate that centers around this Maimar Chazal. But the Gemara says, the reason I'm bringing it, I have a shir on that topic too, but the reason I'm bringing it here is because, what's the Gemara not afraid to do? Avram Avinu did something wrong. The Gemara doesn't say, well, they were enslaved in Egypt 210 years because that was Hashem's master plan. The Gemara says, no, why was Avram punished? What did Avram do wrong that his progeny, that his offspring, had to be in Mitzrayim? So Medrash Tanchuma on Vayigash, source 16. It says, Vayigash, I love Yehuda. Zesha Amar HaKosev, B'ni, Emarafta L'Ra'acha, Takat L'Azar, Kapecha, B'shasha B'kesha Gadosh Baruch Hu Yitenes HaTorah L'Yisrael, when God wanted to give the Torah to the Jewish people, Amar Lami said, Tekablu Torasi, accept my Torah. Amar Lohein, they said, good. God said to them, "Tnuli Arev Shetekayim Mosa." If I'm going to entrust you with something so precious, my Torah, who's the guarantor? Name a guarantor so I can entrust you with my Torah. Amru Lo, so who did Klal Yisrael answer? It's this would be my go-to guarantor. God, you need a guarantor? How about Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov? You are even. Amalahem. God says, they're going to be the guarantors? Avoseichem, hein ba'atzvam tzrichem arevim. They're going to be a guarantor. They need guarantors. They're so reliable. Avram Amar. I promised Avram everything, and Avram turns to me and says, "Bama'idaki Rashana." He's going to be the guarantor when he's skeptical himself. Yitzchak Avasoni. Tichsev es Esav Sanesi. Yaakov Amar Nistra Darki. Amrlo. Beneinu Yarev Mishalon. And the Medrash continues, who's going to be the guarantor? But you see, this Medrash Tanchum is not afraid to say, Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov were so perfect beyond reproach. Kadosh Baruch Hu himself didn't think so. Page 16. We had the story in last week's Parsha. Avram and Lot separate ways. Lot is stealing from other people's fields by allowing his flock to graze. What's Lot's justification? Mefarshim say. Lot says, one second. My uncle was told by God he's going to inherit the whole land. Uncle Avram has no children. Who is going to inherit Uncle Avram? Me. So this is going to be my land someday, so there's nothing wrong with my letting my sheep, my animals graze. Why does Avram take issue with it? The Mefarshim say. Because Avram and Lot looked alike. And when people saw Lot allowing his animals to graze and stealing, they thought it was Avram. And it went against everything Avram was trying to achieve. So they have this conflict, and they say, go your separate ways. And Lot chooses stone. Says the Medrash, Vashem Amar al Avram, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Kas haya la'avinu Avram, B'shar sheperish lo ben achav me'imo. Omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu, L'kolu medabik, U'lulot achav eino medabik. Avram has tolerance for everybody, but he can't tolerate his nephew Lot. Rabbi Nechemia Amar Kasai LaKadosh Baruch Hu B'Shash Hayim Mahalik Lodim Avram Avinu Amar Kadosh Baruch Hu Ani Amarti Lo Lizarach Anasati Yizarach Tazos V'humad Bikas Lod Ben Achav Kedei Liyarsho Im Ken Yelich V'yavu Lo Shnei. The Medrash is not afraid to be critical of Avram and the way that Avram interacted with Lot. Next source. Avimelech, our Parsha. Avram goes to take Tzonu Bakar, he gives it to Avimelech. They come up with a bris between the two of them. Says the Medrash, Vayikach Avram Tzonu Bakar, Vitin Avimelech, Vayomer Avimelech, Mahena Sheva Kvasos, Amalo Kadosh Baruch Hu, Atana Sata Sheva Kvasos, believe it's Tzoni, Chayecha, Shani Masha, Besimchas Banecha, Sheva Doros, Atana Sata La Sheva Kvasos, believe it's Tzoni, Chayecha Keneged Kain, Hor Gimi Banecha, Sheva Tzadikim, the Elohein. Kadosh Baruch Hu was not happy with the way that Avram interacted with Avimelech, and he paid him back for it. I share these midrashim not to get into the particular stories, but I bring them as proof text, as examples of Chazal themselves not hesitating. Who is the Medrash if not Chazal? Where did Chazal have this tradition of a license to look critically at the Avos and the Imos? The Radak also. You know the story? Again, our Parshios. Sarah expels Yishmael from the house. Says the Radak, source 22, Lo nahaga Sarai bezeh lo midas musar v'lo midas chasidus. Not nice. Sarah acted not nicely. Source 23 also, the Radak adds. Here in source 23, the Radak is commenting on the Yaakov. Afabi ben achim kama avtachos lo hayo lalahara lochosh le'esav v'lekaro kama upon them Adoni. When Yaakov reunites with Esav, okay, Yaakov was strategically practicing diplomacy. He didn't have to call him so many times, Adoni, v'lishloch lo mincha gedola, and to send him gifts, u'lishtachavos lo kam upon him to bow down, u'kazeh chet, v'shilim lo hakel b'zeh ha'olam, v'loka b'gufa onesh machshavto. So Yaakov is punished for the excessive, exaggerated way in which he approached Esav. The Radak, Rav David Kimchi, is not afraid to be critical of Yaakov's. We read it, oh, Yaakov was so brilliant. He had this three-pronged approach. It was so beautiful. Oh, Yaakov rose above the tension and was able to try to reconcile. Says the Radak, what are you talking about? It was excessive. It was wrong. They're not afraid to say it was wrong. The great Ramban, source 24, page 18. The great Ramban says, when Avram goes down to Egypt with Sarah and says, listen, we're going on a trip. I forgot to tell you. And we get there, I need you to do something for me. Sure, Avram, what is it? You want me to unpack in the hotel room? What do you need? Put butter on your roll at breakfast? What do you need? Take some extra splendid? What do you need me to do? No, I'm going to need you to say that you're my sister. Says the Ramban, ooh, not good. Know that Avram, our father, unintentionally committed a great sin by bringing his righteous wife to a stumbling block of sin on account of his fear for his life. He should have trusted that God would save him and his wife and all of his belongings, for God surely is the power to help and save. And it was because of this deed that the exile in the land of Egypt at the hand of Pharaoh was decreed for his children. It's interesting that Ramban felt a need to offer a different reason for the exile in Mitzrayim than the Gemara had given. Gemara said it was because Avram conscripted the students into battle. The Ramban says that's not why. It's because Avram shouldn't have done this with Sarah. Ramban felt he had license to be able to do it. The Ksava Kabbalah of Yaakov Mecklenburg, source 25, quotes Ramban, Shebe'emes chait chata gedola b'zeh ad shenigzar abanav ve'ein nira kein midas rabbeinu. He disagrees with the Ramban, but the Ramban nevertheless says it. Two last sources, and with this we end. Source 26, we're back to Rav Hirsch. This is an unbelievable Rav Hirsch. Rav Hirsch says, you know how Esav emerged Esav? Because Yitzchak and Rivka did not parent them the right way. Vayigdalu anarim, they raised Yaakov and Esav exactly the same. They put them in the same cookie-cutter box. They had the same rules, the same expectations. And they should have recognized that Yaakov and Esav were two very different people. And they should have, chanuch lanar al pi darko, they should have parented them in a personalized, individualized, complementary fashion by trying to just make them conform to one standard, it produced an Esav. That's Rav Hirsch's insight about parenting. Obviously very different than what we saw from the others. The Yasnaim, the Torah, Rav Zalman Tzaratzkin also on this, on the parenting, Vayigdalu on the Arim, he also says, V'bneshelo yadam imasav aram shel Esav yosu mashenar mefurish b'torah madua v'bneshelo hishkiach acharav v'lo bada kedaboy ma ma'asav. Rav Zalman Sorotkin is critical of Yitzchak. How could he not know what was going on with Esav? How could he not know? He was an absentee father. He wasn't as vigilant in watching Esav grow as he should have been. These are not my words. They're the words of Rav Zalman Sorotkin. So notice that I'm not telling you who's right. I don't know who's right. Who's right? Who's wrong? You have to ask Rabbi Sement. You have to ask the Mora D'Asra. I don't know what the Minogir is. Who's right? What I wanted to share with you, though, is as we continue to read through the rest of Sefer Bereishis, and in a broader sense, as we approach the question of the study of history and an analysis of our Gedolim, we have these two perspectives. Are they infallible? Are they untouchable? Are they beyond reproach? Are they human? Are they accessible? And while great and categorically different, nevertheless very human. We see the two approaches within our Masorah, and we see examples of it applied in their interpretations of these different segments. Thank you so much for having me. Wishing everyone a wonderful Shabbos.